Well, this evening we'll be returning to the character studies that we've been doing some of over the course of this series of lessons. You remember we talked about Esther and how she grew as a character over the course of the book back on Sunday. And we talked about Ahasuerus and how he is something of a very shallow character. There's not a whole lot to him. His main focus seems to be on power, and we talked specifically in chapter 1 about how that manifests itself and then some of the weaknesses of that sort of perspective and some practical lessons that we can get out of all of that. Today we're going to look at Haman, and that's going to leave Mordecai off the hook for having to study him in some depth because we'll do something completely different tomorrow night. But today we're going to talk about Haman because he's a really fascinating person as well. And we'll follow that same basic pattern of looking at him kind of over the course of the entire book to see what his character looks like, to see what we can understand about him before we look at maybe something of a case study of a specific section of the text that really exemplifies some of these character traits, kind of like chapter 1 did with Ahasuerus. And then we'll draw some practical lessons out of all of it and see how we can avoid being this kind of person and some of the flaws that come with being this kind of person. Haman's a fascinating guy for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons that he is so interesting, or one of the things that makes him so interesting, is that he is an entirely transparent character. Now, we talked about that some with Ahasuerus as well. He was kind of transparent. Everyone could read his emotions because he was so superficial, because he was so shallow and there was really nothing to him. And anyone who looked at him in any way could understand exactly what was going on in his head at any moment. Haman is not transparent because he is superficial. He is transparent because the narrator makes him superficial. Haman is the one that we get told everything about what he's thinking and what he's scheming, even if it's not obvious to someone on an external kind of level. He's not allowed any mysteries at all. His motives are told to us. What drives him is told to us. His attitudes are told to us. And his evil soul is ultimately then laid bare for us. And it may be a way that the author is telling us that evil, however nefarious it may seem, however complicated it may seem, whatever the motives may be, really is a simple thing and pretty obvious when you stop and you think about it. But we see Haman's transparency in a variety of ways. First of all, he is transparent in his emotions. This is kind of like Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was transparent in his emotions. Haman is transparent in this way as well. So notice a few verses just very quickly as we survey the book and consider this. Chapter 3 and verse 5. This is where Mordecai refused to bow to Haman, and Haman is told, we don't have time to talk about all the details here, but notice that Haman doesn't see this himself. He has to be told about this. But it says, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down to him, this is after he has been told about this, he sees now that Mordecai does not bow down to him or pay homage to him, he is filled with fury. And so his emotions come right to the surface as soon as there is a reason for his emotions to come right to the surface. Chapter 5 and verse 9, this is right after the first banquet that Esther has that she invites Haman and the king to. Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. And again, his emotions are right on the superficial level. But then notice in the same verse, when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. And so at one moment he's joyful and glad, and the very next moment he's filled with wrath. And the next verse, but Haman restrained himself, which is, of course, a way of saying that he is battling with his own emotions. Well, he goes home and he has a little bit of a pity party that we'll talk about later. And his wife says, you should go have Mordecai killed. Build these gigantic gallows. Go talk to the king. Have Mordecai killed. And the idea pleased Haman. And he had the gallows made in chapter 5 and verse 14. Chapter 6 is where he has this grand scheme to honor himself. So he thinks. But instead, he has to honor Mordecai. And we're told in verse 12 that Haman hurried to his house after he had to honor Mordecai. He hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. Chapter 7 that we talked about already. After he realizes that Esther is a Jewess and she has identified him as the enemy. In verse 6, he is terrified before the king and queen. His emotions are constantly on the surface. Basically, every scene that he shows up in, his emotions are on the surface, and he is transparent in that regard. But it's not just transparent because he's an emotional guy and you can see his emotions. I mean, a lot of people are emotional people and you know what they're thinking on that basis. A deeper level of Haman's transparency is, as I said a moment ago, brought about by the narrator who tells us what Haman is thinking. In chapter 3, in verse 6, this is right after he was filled with fury in 3:5 that we already read, about Mordecai not bowing down to him. It says in verse 6, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. The nuances of Haman's calculations are told to us. He thought it was beneath himself to just kill Mordecai. And so he wanted to kill more than just Mordecai. Well, how do we know that? We're given insight into the very mind of Haman here in chapter 3 and verse 6. And this isn't the only place. Flip over to chapter 6. And verse 6, here, Haman has shown up in the king's court to beg, or not really to beg, to ask for Mordecai to be killed. The king has been sleepless all night. He decides he wants to honor Mordecai, and you have this very comical scene where the king says, "What can I do for the person that I want to honor?" And Haman, notice it says in verse 6, Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And so he comes up with this scheme where he thinks he is going to be honoring himself. But what leads into this is, again, the narrator giving us insight into Haman's very thoughts. They're quoted verbatim for us. This is what this man was thinking. And we see his perceptions revealed to us as well. In chapter 7, Esther has said, "A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman." And Haman was terrified before the king and queen. And in verse 7, the king arose in his wrath and went from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. Again, insight into Haman's thinking is given here. And we'll come back and talk about chapter 5 in some more detail. But in chapter 5 and in chapter 6, again, you kind of get to watch the wheels turn in Haman's mind. As he goes in chapter 5 from thrilled to angry to listening to advice and calculating it to happy again. And then in chapter 6, to thinking, who would the king want to honor more than me? And he goes through this scheme of what he thinks he's going to be getting and how great that's going to be. And you get to watch the wheels turn as his mental processes are revealed to us as well. There's no other character in the book of Esther that is exposed this way, the way that Haman is exposed this way. Most of the people, you figure out things about them from what they say out loud, or from how they act publicly. Haman is laid bare as his thoughts are quoted verbatim, and we get insight into how he thinks and how he's reacting. And I think what the author is doing here is, by letting him have no secrets whatsoever, by exposing everything about him, he takes the arch nemesis of the Jewish people. Notice he's always Haman, the enemy of the Jews. He's the one that wants to kill God's people. He's the one that wants to stand in the way of God's covenant plan and His eternal purposes. And what the author is doing is laying him bare so that we can fully know him and we can accurately judge him for what he is, which really isn't that impressive of a person at all. I think that's part of it as well, is that Haman is the kind of person who wants everyone to think he's incredibly impressive. But when you get down below the surface level, there's nothing impressive about him at all. And we'll come back and talk about that idea in a little while as well. But notice, in the midst of all of this, you get a glimpse at Haman's motives as well. And there are two things that go hand in hand, and they are power and pride. And of course, people that are obsessed with power and want to get power are people who are prideful sorts of people. And people that are prideful sorts of people are the same kind of people that are constantly going after power. And so again, these are two basic sides of the same coin. But what is it that starts the whole problem? Why is it that he's furious? Well, he's furious in chapter 3 because Mordecai refused to bow to him. "You have injured my pride," is what it really boils down to for Haman's motivations. And because he has a giant ego, any little injury to that ego is seen as a giant injury. And what that is going to need then is a giant reaction. And so he says, I can't just punish Mordecai. And the reason you can't just punish Mordecai is because if you just punish Mordecai, then you're really letting Mordecai have control in some way. At least that's probably how his twisted mind is working. That allows him to have to determine the scope of the conflict. So I'll go beyond Mordecai and hurt more than just him and show him who's really in control here. And so he seeks personal revenge at a national level. What is it that solves this problem in chapter 3? Well, in chapter 3, if you jump down further on, what you find, of course, this is when Haman says, we need to kill all these people. The king says, sure, that's fine. Here's my signet ring. And a copy of the document is going to be issued everywhere, all across the nation. And notice in verse 15, the couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Well, that contrast is an interesting thing in itself. But what I want you to notice here this evening is Haman's pride is injured. Haman is furious. Haman has got to solve this problem. And finally, he does. In the moment that he thinks the problem is solved to his satisfaction, he's ready to just sit down and drink for a bit with the king as if everything is fine. He's relieved, not because Mordecai has been punished at the moment, but because his plan of revenge to solve his injured pride is, in his mind at least, set on an inexorable course. Then chapter 5 that we read already in verse 9, he is thrilled in one moment and furious the next moment. Well, what is it that changes him from thrilled to furious? Well, he's thrilled because Queen Esther invited him to her banquet. Look how special I must be. She has invited me to her banquet. Oh, Mordecai is still not honoring me. I'm angry now. And it's an immediate change from one perspective to another. And what brings it about is his ego being stroked or his ego being attacked? And that's the only difference in those two scenes. Nothing else about his station in life is changed at all that day. It's just whether his ego is being stroked or his ego is being attacked. And that means he's either happy or angry. And again, you see how this is something that just drives him completely. But he comforts himself when he goes home by boasting of his accomplishments to his wife. He's building his own pride back up in this regard. And we'll read that text in a moment when we'll look at chapter 5 more closely. But even this is no good, he says, because Mordecai still won't bow to him. And you get an idea of just how obsessed he is with Mordecai here in this chapter. Mordecai's presence controls all of his thoughts. Mordecai has power over his mind because he is so obsessed with Mordecai. It robs him of all pleasure that he might have from the honor and wealth and power that he actually does have. Even in chapter 6, as he presumes he's the only person the king could want to honor, another bit of pride there. He plans this entire scene to happen in the center court in front of the king's gate, probably where Mordecai would be. He wants Mordecai to see how great he is, so he thinks. And again, Mordecai is directing everything that he does. Haman is someone who is just driven entirely by power and pride. But he's not just a proud person in that he's a smug, obnoxious person. You've seen that kind of pride before, I imagine, at some point in your life. There's that kind of pride, smug, obnoxious pride. And there's also pride in terms of just self-satisfaction. Whether they, openly boast about it or not, they're just continually self-satisfied. And Haman's not that kind of proud either. He is both of those things, but that's not all there is. He is proud to the point that he desperately needs personal confirmation of himself. It is about the most extreme kind of pride that there is, that you're not just proud of yourself and happy about yourself, but if other people aren't patting you on the back too, then you've got a problem. And that's the most dangerous kind of pride probably that there is, because not only then are you annoying to the people around you. Not only are you prone to sin, all kinds of sins that are rooted in pride, but that's the sort of thing that's going to lead to extreme reactions to personal slights, as you see happening with Haman here as well. His satisfaction in himself, his confidence in himself is extremely fragile, is what it is. And again, as you see his thoughts laid bare and his motives laid bare and the fragility of his ego laid bare, he begins to look kind of ridiculous. And I think that's part of the point of what's going on here. Here is this big, scary enemy of the Jews, but he's really kind of ridiculous when you stop and you think about it. And you see that as well in the fact that he is both a clever and foolish person at the same time. Go back to chapter 3 one more time, and you get a glimpse of how he can be clever at the one moment, at least. This is when he goes to the king to suggest to the king that the Jews be destroyed. He says in chapter 3 and verse 8, "There's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not in the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." And the king agrees with this. But notice how cleverly this is put together. He manages to do the entire thing without ever talking about who it is that he's going to destroy, or really why it is that they need to be destroyed. I mean, if Haman is really going to be pressed on this, what it all boils down to is one person of this race did something to offend Haman. And I can't imagine that even this king, as ridiculous as he is at times, would say, "Yeah, that's a really good reason to wipe out the entire race of people." That's just absolutely ridiculous. But he avoids that. He avoids what the real issue is. And he mixes truths and half-truths and outright lies in such a way that sound plausible and convincing to the king. There's this group of people. They're scattered everywhere. They're dispersed among all the people. And their laws are different from the laws of other people. That's all true. The Jews are all over the place after the captivity, during the diaspora. They're all over the place. And their laws are different from the laws of every other people. But notice how when you say that, which is true and really pretty innocuous in itself, there's this people and they're everywhere and their laws are different. I mean, that sounds kind of scary if you're a king. Wait, they're everywhere? Their laws are, they don't follow my laws? And that's probably where it gets into the half-truth part. They don't keep the king's laws. Well, in particular, there was one Jew who didn't keep one law, and that was to bow down to Haman. And probably there were other laws of the king that the Jews didn't keep because it would have gone against their religious following of God. But here's a little bit of half-truth, and then ultimately gets to the outright lie, which you can see how the king would be led along to this point. It's not in the king's profit to tolerate them. Well, of course not, if they're everywhere and they don't follow my laws. Yeah, we got to get rid of these people. Absolutely. But it is in the king's profit to tolerate them. Really, for two reasons. One, as we talked about the other day, one of this very group of people saved the king's life. At the end of chapter 2, Mordecai discovers an assassination plot and saves the king's life. It is absolutely in the king's interest to tolerate the Jews because of that. But from a larger biblical perspective, it is in the king's interest to tolerate them because God said to Abraham a long time ago, "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you." And in Joseph's life, for example, whether in Potiphar's house or whether serving the Pharaoh, when he is blessed by these people are immeasurably blessed as well. And Haman, who tries to curse the Jews, is immeasurably cursed as well. You see this promise working itself out all over the place. Yeah, if the king treated them well, things would go well for him also. It is in the king's interest to tolerate them. But he is clever, is what he is, and he gets the king to go right along with this. But that's about when he exhausts his resources of cleverness. And from that point forward, he just devolves into folly. He gets so angry that he can't wait for revenge. I mean, the whole scene where he goes and asks the king to kill Mordecai is completely unnecessary. He should never have been on hand for his own humiliation in chapter 6 because Mordecai was already marked for death by the decree. If he could have just sat around and waited a little bit, Mordecai would have died by the decree. But he can't wait for that. He's so angry, he rushes to kill Mordecai and get premature revenge, and he is humiliated as a result of that. He erects the instrument of Mordecai's death, so he thinks, which ultimately, is as he rushes straight to his humiliation, becomes the instrument of his own death. His assumption that he is the only one worthy of such honor is what makes him become a public fool as well. His rush to fall on Esther's couch and plead for his life is what lets the king walk in and say, "Would you assault my queen even in my presence?" which leads to his immediate death. After chapter 3, basically everything that Haman does is utterly foolish. And he looks foolish as well, just like he looks shallow and ridiculous when you look at his motives and how fragile it all is. I try not to read lengthy quotes from the pulpit, but I'm going to make an exception for this one because I think it's just so fantastic. This is from a Jewish author, actually, named Michael Fox. And this is what he says about Haman. He says, "By making Haman superficial and silly, the author hits him where his sort would most feel it, in his pride." We can imagine how a person such as the one created in this book would feel about the way that he is depicted. Haman would not be bothered by being shown to be deeply evil, but he would be mortified to be revealed as an impulsive bungler. Isn't that exactly right of boastful, proud, evil people? Yeah, call them evil all you want. They don't care about that. But if they look ridiculous, oh, that would drive them crazy. Fox goes on to say, "I am reminded of Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, a satirical attack on Hitler, which showed the Führer to be not only an evil and dangerous power, but also a gesticulating, screeching, frenetic ninny. Rather than attacking evil in its own terms, Chaplin, like the author of Esther, denigrated it for what, by exposing it for what it most deeply fears to be." Now, pay careful attention to this because I think this is spot on. He attacks evil by exposing it for what it most deeply fears to be: weak within and ludicrous without. And that, I think, is a fantastic reminder to think about as you are surrounded by proud, evil people. Or maybe as you are tempted to join their ranks when things don't go your way, or you see some opportunity to advance your station in some regard. This is what proud, boastful evil is. It's utterly ridiculous, and it is something to be avoided at all costs. Well, let's look a little bit more closely now at chapter 5 and see kind of how this all works itself out there in a little bit more close a study here. Chapter 5, beginning in verse 9. I'll read it again, although we've read some of these verses already. "Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, 'Even Queen Esther let no one but me come with the king to the feast that she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate.' Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Let gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast.' This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made." And so he leaves this banquet, and he is thrilled, joyful and glad of heart. And then he sees Mordecai. And Mordecai doesn't show him his proper respect according to his position in the empire. This is, whatever the case may have been in chapter 3, this is, I think, pretty clearly not a case where Mordecai would be bowing down to him to worship him in some way. It's just a rise to show respect to him, and Mordecai won't even do that. And also that he doesn't tremble before him. And probably the trembling has less to do with awe of Haman's station, but the fact that Haman has issued this edict of their destruction, and Mordecai doesn't even seem to care about that. He's not afraid of even that. And Haman restrains himself and goes home. And you get a glimpse of his anger and his ego as you work through this. Because again, he's flattered by the queen's invitations, but he's incensed by Mordecai's refusal to honor him. And there's something pretty ironic there as well when you stop and think about it. The thing that he's happiest about is far worse for him than the thing that he's upset about. What's more dangerous, that Mordecai won't honor him, or that he is in Esther's crosshairs? Now, he doesn't realize what's going on with Esther. He thinks he's just being honored by Esther. But in reality, Esther is working on a plan that is going to destroy him completely. And so the thing that he is so happy about is ironically the thing that he should be the most concerned with. But then he goes home and he has this little pity party for himself where he recounts to his wife and his closest friends his resume. Now this is in itself a ridiculous thing that speaks volumes about the kind of pride and ego this man has. You know, you go home one day and say, "Honey, let me tell you about my job." Really? "Honey, let me tell you my salary." I'm pretty sure she knows that already. "Let me tell you how many kids I have." Yeah, she definitely knows that one. Yet this is what he is doing. He is so focused on himself that he recounts his riches, then his children, then his prestige in front of the people who are most familiar with all of this. But it's not about telling them. It's about reminding himself. It's about building himself back up because his little ego has been stomped on here. And all of the accomplishments that he has, all of them that he enumerates, he says, none of this is worth anything as long as Mordecai doesn't honor me. But really? I mean, this is the essence of pride. It is so excessively obsessed with self that it could take 100 fantastic things, and it's all undone by one little thing. Ego of this kind is like a balloon. The bigger and bigger and bigger it gets, the smaller of a pinpoint is needed to bring the entire thing down. The more obsessed we become with ourselves and our accomplishments, the easier it is for us to get angry with other people when they slight us, or we just think they might have slighted us. And this is Haman in a nutshell. His whole world revolves around his ego. When his ego is stroked, he feels blessed. Nothing at all has changed about his life when Haman invites him, or when Esther invites Haman to dinner. Nothing changes about his life. He's not higher in the kingdom. He doesn't receive extra money. He doesn't have extra 10 sons that honor him in some way. Nothing changes whatsoever except he feels honored. And so it's the best day he has ever had. Until 5 minutes later, when Mordecai, one little person, doesn't show him respect. And still, nothing about him has changed. He's still in the same position. He hasn't been demoted. His salary hasn't been knocked down. None of his kids have been killed. One little thing, and suddenly it's the worst day that he has ever had, and all the great things that he has doesn't compare to this one little bad thing. This is the danger of ego. Well, what do we learn from Haman as we look at him as a character in this regard? We'll come back to this issue of ego and greatness and perceived greatness in a moment. The first thing that I want to think about here is the fact that sin will suffer from its own hand. How frequently, when bad things happen to us, did we bring it upon ourselves? There's a great verse in Ecclesiastes that says, "He who digs a pit will fall into it." And that may not be the entire point of what the preacher is making there in Ecclesiastes, but I think at least a corollary point there is when you put yourself in a bad situation, bad things are going to happen as a result of it. And you can think about this kind of generally in terms of temptation. You know, you've heard preachers, I'm sure, say your whole life, stay out of tempting situations, at least as well as you can. You can't stay out of them completely, but don't walk straight into them, because that's just a dumb thing to do. The way that I like to think about that issue is to think about B-rate horror movies. That's an interesting analogy, right? I imagine most of you have seen this kind of movie, if not a B-rate horror movie specifically, something else along those lines. And what I'm talking about is there's a killer in the house. You know this movie, right? There's a killer in the house, and the person is outside the house. And what is the person outside the house strongly considering doing at the moment? Going in the house, right? And you sit there, and you scratch your head, and you think, are you kidding me? You have to be the stupidest person on the planet. There's a killer in there. If you go in there, you're going to die. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you go in that house, you're going to die. And then what do? They go in the house and they die. And you just want to bang your head on the table and say, are you kidding me? This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I've ever seen in my life. Well, it's the second most ridiculous thing you've ever seen in your life because you've watched yourself. At least if you're anything like me, you have. Because I know there have been countless times where I look at a place and I know good and well that temptation is going to be there. And if I go there, I'm probably going to sin. And it doesn't take a genius to figure that fact out. And if my life was projected on a screen, the audience would be sitting there saying, what kind of stupid person are you? If you go there, you're going to sin. Anyone can figure this out. What are you thinking? And then what do I do? Surely at least some of you have been in that situation before. Sin suffers from its own hand because we put ourselves in that kind of position and we sin in that kind of way. But sin suffers from its own hand in other ways as well. That sinful people that do sinful things so often have it backfire on them. I'll add to the shock of citing B-rate horror movies by quoting John Calvin. John Calvin said, and I think he said very well, man falls according to how God's providence ordains, but he falls by his own fault. What he's saying is that God is in control, and God's providence means that someone like Haman is going to fall. But Haman ultimately falls by his own hand. God ensures that they will fall, but he lets them fall by their own choices. And you see this in the book of Esther. It speaks of God's providence and his control of events as loudly as any book in the Bible does. But all the way through, Haman is responsible for every step that leads to his own death, all the while thinking that he is safe in his wealth and his power and his prestige. And this is because sin is self-deceptive. Sin is what lets us look at something that we know we shouldn't be doing and say, well, yeah, I've seen everyone else who's tried this get caught before, but I can get away with it. Really, you can. Well, what's going to happen then? I've seen everyone else who's walked down this road end up with a life of disaster of various kinds. But I can handle it. Really, you can. Sin suffers from its own hand because sin is self-deceptive. Haman thought he was proposing his own honor, but he was creating Mordecai's honor. Haman thought he was building Mordecai's gallows, but he was building his own gallows. Haman thought that he was honored by Esther's invitation, but it was an invitation to his own execution. He was deceived. And every step that he took along that path led closer to his own destruction. And how deceived he was. Nothing was what he thought it was, even the things that he himself was doing. And suddenly, without warning, the destination of evil, you arrive there. And divine justice has its way at that point. And this, I think, is in itself a very humbling kind of thought. Because at the final judgment, all truth is going to be revealed. And all lies are going to be exposed. And every step of evil that we've taken, thinking that we can get away with it, thinking that no one was going to know, thinking that we could live however we wanted to live, deceiving ourselves all the way down. All of those lies are going to be stripped away, and all that's going to be left is divine justice. And the condemned will realize that they have no one to blame but themselves. It's a terrifying and humbling thought. And the real danger is how deceptive sin is. That we let ourselves believe these lies because we want to believe these lies. We need to stop and take a really good look at ourselves. However we can, so that we don't fall prey to this. You've heard people say, I imagine, from time to time, the camera adds 10 pounds, or 5 pounds, or 15 pounds, or whatever they want the number to be to feel good about themselves. I try to remind myself when I see pictures that I'm not terribly happy with, no, the camera doesn't add 10 pounds. It just strips away my self-delusion. It's going to be more so at the final judgment. However we have deluded ourselves is all going to be stripped away. And it will be us and God and nothing but the truth of our situation. We need to find that camera that exposes us to ourselves. And the Bible tells us that the Bible is that camera, so to speak. It's the mirror that we look into and we see ourselves and we see the truth of ourselves. If we will believe it, it can strip away all the lies as we hold ourselves up to it as the standard. And we realize where we fall short if we are honest with the Bible. And we let the Bible do that work to us. That's where we go to avoid this suffering from our own hands. To avoid the self-deception of sin. But then also, I would point out from Haman, we see that false greatness is going to collapse eventually. There are two basic kinds of greatness in the world. There are some people who, at least humanly speaking, are truly great people. Now, I don't mean that in some sort of blasphemous sort of way, obviously. But humanly speaking, at least, they're great men and women in the world. They accomplish incredible, incredible things. They lead other people to make really good decisions, and they're fantastic influences in that regard. They make the world, at least the world around them, a better place. And some make countries a better place, or even the entire world in itself a better place. And the thing about this kind of greatness is that this kind of great person doesn't need to be told about their greatness, and quite frankly, they don't want to be told about their greatness. They don't like to hear about that kind of thing. But then there's the other kind of greatness, so to speak, and it's those people who desperately want to be great. They convince themselves that they are great, and then they desperately want everyone else in the world to believe that they are great as well. And usually it's easy enough to tell the difference between real greatness and false greatness by spending about 5 minutes with somebody. And you'll know whether they have either of these kinds of traits. I mean, you think about some of the differences in these two kinds of people. There are some who are proud and some who are humble. And real greatness of character leads to humility because it can see its own failures. But false greatness covers its own shortcomings. It's only interested in making itself look better. Pride is the hallmark of it, not humility. It's the more we want to cover up our failings rather than admit them and grow from them, that speaks to the kind of person that we are. But it's not just pride and humility. There's also the issue of resentment or patience. As we said with Haman, the bigger your ego gets, the easier it is to pop. The more obsessed you are with yourself, the easier it is to bring you down in some way. The most minuscule slight leads to the greatest wrath. And the bottom line here is that the more we are inclined to pretend like we've got it all together, the more we want to cover our own sins or that we fail to see our own sins, the less we realize that we are in need of grace, the less grace we're ever going to show to anyone else. The more perfect we are, the more exaggerated their sins are going to be. That's just how it works. If we can't see our own sins, then everyone else's sins are going to be magnified by comparison, especially when they come into our lives. But the better we understand our sinfulness, a true understanding of ourselves, that makes it easy to be patient with other people. That makes it easy to be forgiving to other people, because we begin to understand just how much we have been forgiven. Which leads to the third pair of traits to distinguish true greatness and false greatness, and that is whether someone wants to take revenge or whether they are willing to forgive. Whether they want to get their pound of flesh, however that works itself out. I doubt most people who seek revenge today will seek it through genocide, as Haman did, but there is some way that we want that person to get what's coming to them, preferably if we can provide it, but if not, at least we can stand on the sideline and point and laugh when it happens, or something along those lines. Well, Haman was filled with fury, and he wanted revenge. An interesting thing about that is the Hebrew word that's used there for fury is the word hema, which sounds strikingly like Haman. And I think the author is using that word out of all the words that he could use to describe that on purpose, that even his name is filled with fury, so to speak. But here's the reality again. Oversized egos, they abruptly deflate, and they desperately need to prop themselves back up. And they do that by taking vengeance on the person who has hurt them. And so for Haman, it's beneath him to take vengeance on Mordecai alone. You know, we thought the Persians overreacted back in chapter 1 with that edict to all the empire. Haman makes Ahasuerus look like Mr. Moderation by comparison. But truly great people can forgive because they understand that they have been forgiven. But here's what I want you to think about as we think about false greatness. And that is that in a very real sense, whatever greatness there is in us is a false greatness. However great we may be humanly speaking, none of us is great from a very different perspective. God has far more reason to destroy us than Ahasuerus ever had to destroy the Jews. We have not always bowed to Christ. The laws that we would want to follow are different from our King's laws. As cosmic rebels to the goodness of God, it is not in His profit to tolerate us. And there is an accuser who stands before God and makes that case to God over and over, and the edict of destruction for us should have been written long, long ago. But our King has done something different. Rather than passing off the signet ring for our destruction, rather than hearing the case against us, He gave His Son over to His enemies instead of giving us over to the enemies. Rather than taking our livelihoods away, He let His Son be plundered by His enemies so that He was left with nothing and that we may have everything. Rather than letting us be executed, He let His Son be destroyed and killed and annihilated in our place. This is the King that we serve. A King who does not do what He should do from one perspective, but does what is humble and giving so that we can be truly great people. And we extend the invitation to anyone who needs to come to this King, to give your life to Him, to make Him the King of your life, and serve Him and Him only. And if there's some way that we can help you this evening, won't you let it be known as together we stand and sing.